It's 32 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the wake-up call here on a Friday morning. And I am pleased to be joined by Michael Ansara, Associate AD at Central Connecticut State University. Mike is a guy I have known for quite a while. We were former colleagues, and he has had some very insightful posts on Facebook, and a very thoughtful guy. This is a guy that, even when I worked with him, he's a guy that thinks a lot and has a lot of things to say. And good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good morning, Gene. Long time, my friend.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again. You know, one of the things that you said, I saw a Facebook post you had this morning, and one of the things that you said was that we need to say less and do more. You know, we have a lot of talking going on right now, but we also have a lot of action. You know, it's hard to say the right thing. You know, if you're a person like, well, let's make an example. Drew Brees from the New Orleans Saints came out and made a comment about the national anthem, about kneeling, and Ellen DeGeneres came out and said something about the Black Lives Matter movement. But no matter what anybody says, especially a person that is not of color, it is difficult to say the right thing. So what should people be saying or doing? Or maybe we shouldn't be saying, we should be doing. So are the protests and the things going on around the country, is that what we should be doing right now?
Well, first off, it's always difficult. You have a climate and time when what is politically correct.
Yeah.
And that depends on who's saying it and who's listening to it. So you know me, Gene, I've always been one to speak from the heart and try to be cognizant and aware of my words and how powerful they could be or how hurtful they could be. It's understandable that, or it's easy to see that sometimes people may have very good intentions and is misunderstood or is taken and slanted in whatever manner it is that reflects the hearer's beliefs. But at this time, it's really when people should be going from their social and developing moral conscience, and it is the point of less talk and more action. My post this morning, I said I talked about how, you know, in another 251 days, people will have 250 days. People will have the opportunity to do and exhibit the utmost in protesting, which will be by their vote.
Right.
Everyone has the right of conscience and the ability to vote in whatever manner, but you have an opportunity now for your voice to be heard at the highest level, change policies and laws that reflect your beliefs. So that's what I say less and do more. At this point, consider the internal review and analysis of your thought process, and we can talk about some things that I can share with the audience, maybe give them a platform to do to start off on. But the actions now and the support of actions that will sometimes might be uncomfortable, but very necessary.
You said something, in some of your posts on Facebook, there have been people that have reached out to you and said, hey, thank you, because this gave them a forum to talk to their children, to, you know, and I think that this is the important part. We see a lot of young people at these protests, which is great. You know, a lot of the kids at CCSU organized a protest that you went to yesterday. But we also have to get to the kids even younger than that. And as parents, we need to reach out to them now and make this, I guess, for lack of a better term, a teaching moment, don't we?
Oh, exactly. Without a doubt. I saw a news article yesterday that there was a woman who had her toddler. She couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years old. A white woman and her little daughter, and they were at the march in Black Lives Matters, and she was trying to explain to her daughter that the daughter's best friend and their neighbors are people of color. And the little girl was upset with how people were acting and things that she was seeing on the TV and saying, but I love my friends. So the mother found it prudent to take her little girl out to be involved and see at such a young age because, you know how it goes. Our racism and prejudice is something that's learned.
Right.
It's not something that you're born with.
You have.
You know, I'll also just add this real quickly. Obama said something the other day about, and I quote, "Ultimately, it's going to be up to a new generation of activists to shape strategies that best fit the times." And he said, "I believe that there's some basic lessons that were drawn from the past that's worth remembering. First, I will say the civil rights movement of the 60s, there were NAACP was championed by people who were not of color, but the protests by and large were minorities.
Right.
African Americans, Negroes as they called them in those times. Now when you look at the protests, and it's literally not only in the United States, but around the world where the ground is shaking, the earth is wobbling. Because it's a matter of our basic existence now. We breathe the same dirty air. We drink the same dirty water. Unless you live in Flint and they haven't fixed that yet. But it's critical. Yeah. But we're finding that the issues of inadequate health care and poor education, we're finding all those things are interconnected. And I can't live without you, and you can't live without me.
You've lived through this before. You have, you know, you grew up in the 60s, and you... saw what was happening then. How this, it must be difficult for you, you know, 60 years on, to see that in some ways the dream that Dr. King had, we still haven't gotten there. That must, is it discouraging for you, Michael?
Like the post I put this morning, I've gone to some protests in Hartford. The one I went to yesterday was coordinated by students at CCSU. And that was very prideful because, you know, if you asked me 6 months ago or a year ago, I would maybe have an opinion that young people right now don't care about anything. It's a me, me, me generation.
Right.
But something has definitely changed. Something changed. And it was really prompted by something that was intolerable, or the most recent event that they share on social media, and the light went on.
Yep.
And it is disheartening when I'm hearing the protester following behind me, but he was not in protest of what we were there for. He was basically spewing words of hate. You know, I won't repeat some of the things that he said, but you can imagine where you're calling people criminals and terrorist organizations. And then he used that trigger word. He used that word mm-hmm. that rhymes with trigger and rhymes with digger. But he didn't say that. And it took the greatest reserve that I could muster. My hands were clenched. My jaws started getting tight. Because I remember being run from the train station in my neighborhood in New York, which was right around the corner from my block.
Right.
And we were the second black family on the block, or have been in a professional situation where those words and their actions were shared, or their actions were apparent, where they were biased. And but I still have hope. I have hope. If you give me a chance, I'll quote something that Muhammad Ali said. And it really relates to what's been my mantra and what gets me through. And let me just try to find this thing. But he talks about what is impossible, and he defines impossible. He said impossible is just a big word thrown around by small men who find it easier to live in a world they've been given than to explore the power they have to change it. Impossible is not a fact. Impossible is an opinion. Impossible is not a declaration. Impossible is a dare. Impossible is potential. Impossible is temporary. Impossible is nothing. So when I work and talk to young people and I ask them, spell impossible for me, and they go, I-M-P, I go, stop. And they start, I said, start over again. And they go, I-M-P-O. I said, okay, in the root of words, the way I'm looking at it is, I'm possible. You're possible. And one of the things that you have to do is to really see the power that you have, in essence, to literally change the world. Because I tell them all the time, one day I'm going to get old, and they will make decisions that's going to impact me as a retiree soon to come, one day, as well as getting to be an elder. And I used to claim that they would also have responsibilities over my yet-to-be-born grandson, and I've been blessed because my grandson's about 3.5 months old now. So it has more meaning to me because it's never been about me. It's always been about other people.
Right. I mean, based on what you've just said, you then sound like you are optimistic that perhaps this could be the thing. Maybe this is the moment. Maybe George Floyd's death won't be in vain. Maybe this will be the trigger that gets us to where we need to be. I mean, that must be what you're hoping for.
Oh, I'll share with you, it's not just me. I think it's hope, and it will be people rolling up their sleeves to do that now in the masses. There's many organizations around the country and around the world that speak and work on behalf of equity and social justice and criminal justice and the like. There's one organization called the Center for Social Inclusion, and George Glenn Harris, he was asked, what is racial equity? And he said, racial equity is about applying justice and being and a little bit of common sense to a system that's been out of balance. When a system is out of balance, people of color feel the impact most acutely, but to be clear, an imbalanced system makes us all pay. That's food for thought.
You know, it's interesting that all we wanted to talk about in this country, or all we could talk about in this country, was the pandemic. We seem to have found something that has made people say, you know what, the pandemic isn't that important. That and again, it's kind of amazing that now it's like it's more important that we get out and we express the change that we want. And we don't care about it. I mean, I know people are still out there wearing masks, but those are rather big crowds. And all of a sudden, the pandemic isn't that big a deal.
Well, if you think to the gravity of it, everything is still kind of interrelated, I think. You know, I do agree, and I post that the pandemic hasn't gone away, but what that did is also show another era of glaring inequities, and whether it relates to who's the most being afflicted,
right,
the services provided in a particular locale, location, hospitals, the need for people to be trained appropriately so that services can be offered without staff being shorted. It's still a matter of life and death. And at this point, like I said, one man's life did change the perspective. But I last spoke, I saw a video of George Floyd's daughter, and she was asked, tell me about your daddy. And her response was, my daddy changed the world. So I can see how people can be inspired by a little girl's premonition and a little girl's outlook that still hasn't probably understood that her father, her daddy, is never coming home again. But she can say with the brightest smile on her face, my daddy changed the world. So I encourage people, let's not make her a liar. Let's make that happen. Because it's possible. It might have seemed improbable a couple months ago or many years ago, but it's right in front of us. And it's something that, like I said, is sweeping all over. And people are caught up, and I'm hoping that it's just not an emotional reaction, but a heartfelt response.
One of the posts that you had on Facebook, you gave a list of a number of things where you thought that people needed to stop and think, and some things they needed to challenge themselves. And one of the things that you said was to challenge the colorblind ideology. What did you mean when you said that?
Well, ideology is really a culmination of thoughts and feelings that's used to create policy or to create a platform. So that's the definition that I see of ideology. But the colorblind part, when people say, I don't see color, I won't say that that's not true, but it's not true. In everyday life, you do see color. You're descriptive in how you may talk about a pair of shoes or a suit or a tie or a woman's dress.
Right.
Every day you see color when you drive the street and you get to a corner and there's a stoplight. So you know what a red light means. You know what a green light means. Nobody pays attention to the amber light. You also know what green means when those dollar signs, those dollars have numbers on them. You know what it means. It has a gravity to it. But most often, you know, the thing when it comes to race and color, sometimes people subliminally, they may say, I'm in support. But there's a fair, I'll never forget one day, I'm with my son. And I've always tried to teach my son different things from when he was young. So we lived in this area in Cromwell, in the condo area. And he used to walk the neighbor's dog. So one night, we went out to help him walk the neighbor's dog, and the next door neighbor to him is a woman. She's always seen us. Oh, we lived there for years. But that particular night, when she came outside, she clutched her purse under her arm. And then she sat in the car and watched us until we drove away. And I asked him, how did that make you feel? And he goes, not very good. Because why would you do that? She sees us all the time. Something happened that moment that she felt uncomfortable. Now, mind you, the people would have to understand that I'm also 6'9".
Right.
And that brings its own interpretations and feelings of reactions and interpretations of how they think and feel. But so when I say you have to really get over that, to be honest, where there is really no difference. If you look at dogs, puppies, and the puppies are mixed in colors, you may define which one, a white one, a black one, a tan one, a brown one, but they're all still the same. They came from the same litter.
Right.
It didn't really matter. It was just a matter of preference. And that's what I ask, that people, you get away from that.
Well, one of the other things that you said in this post, and I think you just kind of alluded to it, is to validate the experiences and feelings of people of color. And I don't think there is any other better example than what you just cited about what you had to go, what you and your son experienced just by this woman seeing you and acting afraid. She made you uncomfortable at the same time. And although uncomfortable, it must have also angered you a little bit. You must have wanted to say to her, lady, you know who I am. But you also knew if you had done that, it would have exacerbated the situation. Somebody that looks like me would never have to worry about something like that. And I don't think a lot of people think like that.
Hey, I'll tell you, I'll make some levity in telling a quick story, because you know I'm a great storyteller, trying to be.
Yeah.
So down the street from my house is a CVS. And a couple weeks ago, newsflash came on, black male, 6'2 to 6'7, 205, 215 pounds, black sweatsuit, black hoodie, baseball cap, and a gun. And he robbed the store in broad daylight. Newsflash came on, we got the COVID virus, and coupled with the virus and that event, I didn't leave the house for about a week. When I finally did leave the house, I went to a store that's down the road from the store. And I'm leaving the store, and a man walked in the store, literally in my path, stopped, looked me up and down, and said, and waved his hand, and said, I'd recognize you anywhere, and just walked away. What was he referencing? Because I fit the description of the person that robbed the store.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's not, you know, you said levity. It's not really funny when you think about it, because I referenced this morning. I would never even ever have to worry about that. And I think that's the point here, is that people don't understand what it's like to walk in your shoes. And not, you know what? And it's not just African Americans. Hispanic people face the same thing. A lot of people immediately, you know, they see somebody who's Hispanic and they think, well, this guy's got to be a criminal. You know, and so, but the people that look like me don't ever have to think that way. And that, I think, is what you were getting at when you said that they need to validate what people of color are facing on a daily basis, right?
Correct. And the feelings, you know, you, my grandmom would always, she was born in 1910. And she would tell me stories of her growing. And one of the stories that I remembered, and the anniversary was that, was just May 31st. But it was May 31st, 1921. She was 10 years old. And she told me a story about the Tulsa Massacre and what that was like and how she felt. And through the 60s and 63 and 64, 65, 67, 68, 69. And she would always tell me that people will always try to put labels on you. But then she also tried to instill a sense of pride and hope by way of my race and my culture, that historically, I come from a stock of kings and queens, great scientists, orators, and engineers. And if that's not the case, that's how she tried to tell me that I could be a great scientist, orator, or engineer. Well, I chose to try to be a great orator and writer.
Reverend Al Sharpton yesterday in the eulogy for Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis talked about how, you know, that George Floyd may have been killed by having a police officer on his, you know, kneel on his neck. He said, but, you know, there has been a symbolic knee on the neck of African Americans in this country forever, from the time, you know, from the time of slavery. And it is time for that to stop and to get your knee off our neck. How did you feel when you heard him say that? I mean, was it like, damn right? Or, you know, I mean, is that too inflammatory, I guess, is what I'm asking you? Or is that the message that needs to be out there right now?
I'll give him the respect for his opinion and how he tried to share those, because that embodies his spirit and what he's tried to champion his whole life. So I might have said it differently. And what I will say is that I would share that you have to remember that all forms of oppression are connected. I don't care if it's Black, I don't care if it's Latino, I don't care if it's the LGBTQ community. It really doesn't matter, because you can't fight against one form of injustice and not fight against all of them, because an injustice is an injustice and it's wrong. But there has been, it is an interesting scenario, because go back, I'd ask any listeners to inquire and be inquisitive enough to go look at the Kerner Commission report, K-E-R-N-E-R, Commission report, and Lyndon Johnson commissioned that report in 1963. And what he wanted to find out at that point is, why are these race riots occurring? And why have we lost control? And what's going on? So that commission was composed of somebody like John Lindsay, who was a mayor in New York when I grew up. It had Roy Wilkins, who was the chair of the NAACP. But he also had CEOs and bipartisan representation, political representation. And in essence, that report said the riots were a result of frustration and rebellion against the urban decay, poor health care, poor housing, inadequate schools, police brutality, bias. That is a government document on the books from 1963, but most people, they don't know anything about it, nor when they started to make changes in the civil rights bills, and everything kind of seemed to relax, and marches, and look at Hartford. Mayor Milner was the first African-American mayor in Hartford, but he was also the first African-American in New England. Johnny M. Floyd was the first African-American director of admissions at Central, the largest of the four state universities, the flagship institution, but he was also the first African-American admissions director in New England. Those are all 60s, 70s as a progress. You know, we've made great strides. I had an opportunity to go to a Ivy League prep high school. I'm from the inner city, Brooklyn, New York, a single parent household with six siblings, and I'm the youngest to go and graduate from the Ivy League institution. So I know that things can happen, but it just didn't seem to happen as well as it could to benefit an overall society that maintains a certain degree of power and control. So when he says off my neck, I hope you can see through the lines. I won't disparage his comments. I would just say it a different way. We know better. It's been proven that we know better. Now we're just in the position, contemporary 2020, that people say, let me try, let's do this now. Because those young kids out there protesting, and many of the people of non-color that are protesting, they were born in the 60s. Some experienced this life before, but they were born in the 60s and lived through the 60s, and now their children are the ones that are saying, I know better, and I want to live in a world where I've gone to school, I've played sports with a diverse group. I know what it's like. I have a different sense. And the power brokers and the policy makers, I'm asking that they change what's on the books right now and how we do things and how we operate.
Well, as you said earlier, we all have a chance. Then the biggest change we can make is coming up here in 250 days when we go to the ballots, because the president that we have has done nothing but divide this country from the time that he was elected. And I don't think meaningful change is going to happen if he is given another 4 years. I only see things getting worse. So I think it is incumbent on everybody who cares about this issue to go to the ballot and make sure that the change is made at the top first.
Definitely, without question. Hey, there's some reasons why, and some other things behind the scenes that make it very apparent that you have to exercise that right to vote and stand behind the politicians that stand for your principles. So you had Aubrey, the young man in Georgia that was killed a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago, and the videos just surfaced. And Georgia doesn't have a hate crime law on the books.
Right.
I found that to be incredible. More importantly, you have another senator that is holding up legislation or holding up a condemnation and censure of the president who utilized military troops to clear the path on the street during a peaceful protest so he could walk across the street to a church that's hollowed ground in an act of blasphemy. Then you have a Speaker of the House that you also have another notable politician that is debating whether lynching is actually a crime.
Good Lord.
I have to ask you to really think about that one.
Yeah.
I have to really ask you to think about that. Is lynching a crime? That's where the change has to come.
Right.
Because he does not speak for me. Because if he doesn't speak for me or people that look for me, look like me, then that gives free rein for someone to act in that manner and know that there will never be any retribution. And that's the problem. That's just a basic problem of living and breathing and existing of humanity and life. That's the epitome of a tragedy that's been done many years over, documented over, that at one point that was a part of, let's have a social gathering at the square, and that kind of activity was done for amusement. And you're going to ask me now in 2020 in debate, is that a crime? He can't speak for me, and I definitely know he doesn't speak for many, many people right now, regardless of race, color, sex, creed, religion, sexual orientation, and the like.
Well, there is obviously a lot more we could talk about here, but we're going to have to leave it there for today, and we'll have you on again to talk about this, Mike, as things go along. And I want to thank you for what you've done on Facebook. Your posts have been, I think they've been eye-opening for a lot of people, and looking at the comments that people have made, I think you have touched a lot of people, and I think you have made a lot of people think, and hopefully that anybody listening this morning feels the same way. So thank you very much for what you're doing. And the community that you live in and what you've had to endure yourselves over the years, this is something that that is a passion. And you grew up with it, and we had hoped it would be gone by now, but maybe. And I'm just going to hang on to that because I like to be a glass half full kind of guy. I'm hoping that this is finally the moment when things change.
Time will tell. First off, Gene, I appreciate you. I thank you for the opportunity. I look forward for any others that you may share. To any listeners, I hope that my words were one of motivation, one that were thought-provoking, that I was informative, persuasive, and somewhat entertaining. But in essence, it would give you chances to do some reflection and to act responsibly.
All right, my friend, we will talk to you soon. Again, thank you very much. Mike Ansara here on Sports Country Radio. We're going to take a break for the news. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to The Wake Up Call on Sports Country.